special people at our house. Emmanuel is remembered very well by the children. Whenever they hear his name, that's the man that sounds like a train whistle. He always makes sure that they hear that train whistle anytime he sees them, and they appreciate it. But Emmanuel, as you probably assume, sent me off to the school of preaching, probably when a lot of people would have been afraid to send me anywhere, based on my appearance at the time. I'm surprised he didn't introduce me. He likes to tell people about the motorcycle that was stolen 2 weeks before my marriage being the best thing that ever happened to him. It wasn't the best thing that ever happened, but it was probably one of the better things. I will admit that. Before we begin the lesson, though, I'd like to take just a minute to encourage you, if you're not a supporter of this school, to become one. I'm glad that this school was started. I encouraged Emmanuel for several years to start a school somewhere, and I believe he's picked the right location to do it. And I would encourage some of the students as they graduate to consider migrating just slightly to the west of here. I was born and raised in Columbus. I was 24 years old before I found out about the Lord and His church. I looked for it beginning at age 15. Couldn't find it. I know it was there. We need more people out there telling the story, talking to people, encouraging other people to do it. And this school will do that. So if you're not a supporter of this school, I encourage you to do so. It's my understanding that there's a scholarship fund that's been established. That might be a good place to make some contributions. The money will be placed there, and just the interest then used to help support students. Student support is important. If this school is anything like Memphis was, and I think the workload is pretty comparable, a student has no time to work, except maybe to go out on a Sunday and preach for a congregation somewhere occasionally. We went to the Memphis School of Preaching. We had $650 a month. We were told we needed $1,000. We were able to get all the way up to $875 a month. I don't say that for any sympathy on my part, but to simply emphasize how hard it is sometimes for people that want to go to school to raise sufficient funds. We survived. As you can tell by looking at me, I didn't go hungry those 2 years. But it wasn't always as easy as it could have been because of the financial situation. So it is money well invested in the Lord's cause, in my opinion, to support schools like this. So I encourage you to do that if you will. Now for our lesson. Like Brother Kessinger, I wrote the manuscript for the book a long time ago. Unlike Brother Kessinger, I've not forgotten about this assignment. It has lived with me day and night. And as a result, I have thought of many different things that needed to be said in that manuscript, many different points that could be made, several different ways to present the material this morning. And so as a result, what you're going to hear this morning is much different from what is in the book. That's not to say that I don't think what is in the book is not good. I believe it could have been much better. But it's because I believe these are some additional things that need to be brought out. And so as we consider the value of life, it's important to begin, I think, with a couple definitions. The Oxford Dictionary of the English Language defines value as, quote, the worth, desirability, or utility of a thing, or the qualities of a thing, end quote. Life, among other things, is defined by that same dictionary as the condition that distinguishes active animals and plants from inorganic matter, including the capacity for growth, function, activity, and continual change preceding death. Kind of a technical definition, I guess. We all understand what life is compared to inorganic matter such as rocks and dirt. But I want to ask the question this morning for you to consider for just a moment, and that is, how do we determine value? More specifically, how do we determine value when it comes to life? There are a lot of people with a lot of different answers to that question out there this morning. And they're all competing for acceptance among the masses. So how do we determine value? Where do we start? What's the basis that we build on to establish the value of anything? Well, in many cases, perhaps most cases, we determine that based on its origin. For example, in Matthew's home, my son Matthew came to mind there, I guess, in Emmanuel and Judy's home, there are several pictures on the wall in one of the rooms. They were drawn, they were painted, or colored by young children. If you would ask Emmanuel and Judy about those pictures, they would tell you that they are probably very valuable to them. However, if they were to take and put them in expensive frames and take them to Christie's auction house and try to place them in an art auction, they wouldn't be worth a whole lot, would they? Probably wouldn't get very much money. Probably couldn't get them in the auction house to begin with. Again, because of their origin. In the office in the church building in Springfield, Ohio, for the last 5 years I was there, there was hanging from a plant hanger on my wall a piece of string about this long. About halfway down, it had a plastic golf ball that has the little holes in it. And on top of that was a little pie pan about that big around. At the bottom, there were two cookie cutters and another golf ball tied. And people would look at that and they would ask me, "What in the world is that?" That was a Father's Day present from my then 5-year-old son, Luke. I still have it. When we moved to Clemens, he said, "Dad, please don't hang that up in your office." So I didn't, but I still have it. It's valuable to me because of where it came from. The value of life is very much dependent upon where it comes from. Now, we know this morning, we know fully this morning, that we are here as a result of the creation of God. I noticed on Monday that there was someone who spoke about origins. So I'm not going to spend a great deal of time to talk about that today. But we understand how God in 6 days created the heavens and the earth and all that in them is. And that mankind was God's crowning creation. He formed Adam out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And Adam became a living soul. And then because there was not a proper helper for life, help meet the King James has, suitable helper, New King James, I believe, God then created Eve from the side of Adam. And he told them to be fruitful and multiply. And they did. We are here as a result of that. We owe our origin in this universe to God. The scriptures inform us that that creation of mankind, of humanity, was special and unique from all the other creation because we are created in the image and likeness of God. Inside each and every one of us is something of God. And that something, I think, is what motivates us, moves us to be creatures who, according to one man's definition, are incurably religious. Now, that religion is emphasized in many different ways, but mankind, throughout the history of mankind, has been incurably religious because of the fact that we are seeking that which we are made in the image of. We are seeking Him whose image we are made in. We understand that this morning. Once upon a time in this country, perhaps not that long ago, that was the dominant and prevailing view. It's not so anymore. There's another view of origins that has challenged and become accepted in many circles. It's the theory of evolution. I want to read for you from a book by Dr. Peter Singer. Dr. Peter Singer has made the news recently. He's been appointed a tenured position as a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. He's a prolific writer, apparently, having written 13 or 14 different books. He's from the nation of Australia. One of the books he wrote many years ago was called Animal Liberation. It is now the Bible for the animal rights movement. The organization PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, used that book religiously to instruct them in their views. In his book, Practical Ethics, Dr. Singer wrote this concerning evolution. There is a huge gulf between humans and animals was unquestioned for most of the course of Western civilization. The basis of this assumption has been undermined by Darwin's discovery of our animal origins and the associated decline in the credibility of the story of our divine creation made in the image of God with an immortal soul. He's talking about, I think, the teachings that became popular around the turn of the century that says that the Bible is not really what it claims to be. That the Bible itself is a product of an evolutionary process. Perhaps you've read someone who's talked about the different writers of the Old Testament being the priestly writer and the Jehovahistic writer, an Elohistic writer, and a redactor. One writer wrote from the Northern Kingdom perspective, another from the Southern Kingdom perspective, and the priestly wrote all the things concerning religion and how all of this grew and evolved. And then this redactor came along and he did some editing and he tried to put it all together. That's how we know, for example, that the book of Genesis, chapters 1 and 2, contains a creation myth and not an inspired record from God. They tell us. Nothing could be further from the truth. But you see, the theory of evolution has dominated almost every aspect of society. It's not just about animals to man creation, monkeys to man. It's applied in various fields of science. It's even applied in religion. Dr. Singer is an obvious believer in this. He goes on to discuss other things that he thinks are damaging to the traditional creationist view. Well, what does Dr. Singer say then concerning ethics? Let me read a couple quotes for you. What does he say about the value of life? Again, from this book, Practical Ethics. He writes, quote, "Human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping that they exist over time. They are not persons," end quote. Now, in his defense, you need to read his definition of a person, which we don't have time to do this morning. But notice that he says that babies are not self-aware of their existence. I'm not sure how he knows that. I remember having four different babies come to my home to stay. Not a one of them told me whether they were aware of their self-existence or not. I have an idea they probably did know they exist because they knew very well when they were hungry, when they were scared, when they wanted their diapers changed, when they wanted to be held, when they were alone. My son Luke used to cry occasionally from the other room where his crib was. All we had to do was speak to him and he would calm right down. So I don't know how Dr. Singer can determine that a child is not aware or capable of grasping the fact that he's self-aware. But because of what Dr. Singer says about babies and animals, which he says are self-aware of their existence, quote, "The life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee," end quote. Remember who this man is, where he works. He's in the Department of Bioethics at Princeton University. He's going to be helping to train some of the elite of our nation, doctors, lawyers, politicians. This is what he believes. He advocates the idea that a child that's born with a disability, the parent should be given at least 28 days to determine whether or not they want the child to live. He also believes that those who are terminally ill should have the right to end their existence. And in certain situations, that decision could be made for them. Because he has rejected the concept that we are created in the image of God and therefore life is in some special and unique way sacred. I hope we can begin to understand, if we haven't already, why the doctrine of origins is so important. He can come to these conclusions and gain support because others agree with what Darwin said. We're not created in the image of God if we're the product of evolution. If Darwin's right, then Dr. Singer very well may be right. But we know this morning that Dr. Singer is not right. We are created in the image of God. We know that there's a God. We know that. I know that, and I think you know that. We can prove it. Well, I have a question. If we know that Dr. Singer is wrong, we know that we're created in the image of God, why is it we have people like Dr. Singer who are becoming so prominent? Why is it that the doctrine of evolution is taught as a fact and not a theory? That it's so accepted by the media and the academic world? I remember being taught the first time evolution in 7th or 8th grade. It's now in the cartoons. Bugs Bunny believes in evolution, I learned long ago. It's in the children's programs. It's in the children's books. How is it that that came about? Well, I don't know if we can really answer for sure this morning how it came about, but we know it has. Well, my question this morning then for us is, what can we do about it? How can we counteract this influence? I don't have a PhD. Princeton's not going to hire me to go up there and teach the other side of things. What can I do? I believe we can do the same thing that they did in the first century. Which, first of all, we need to understand was not dependent on electing the right government officials. I appreciate what Brother Ramsey said about that the other day. Now, I'm not saying that it's not important to try and elect the best people that we can. We need to do that. It's not certainly not going to hurt any to elect people who are believers in pro-life, who believe in God, who accept the creation story, who understand that we are created in the image of God. That's certainly good if we can do that. But I don't really believe that that's going to bring about a solution to this problem. We need to do the same thing they did in the first century. I'd like to read for you a quote from a book, however, before we look at what they did. To have some kind of a concept of the world into which they went. I have here a quote from a book entitled A Day in Old Athens by William Stearns Davis. Under the chapter 8, The Children, he writes this. Subheading Desirability of Children. Besides the oversight of the slaves, an Athenian matron had naturally the care of the children. A childless home of one of greatest of calamities. It means a solitary old age and still worse, the dying out of the family and the worship of the family gods. There is just enough of the old superstitious ancestor worship left in Athens to make one shudder at the idea of leaving the deified ancestors without any descendants to keep up the simple sacrifices to their memory. Besides, public opinion condemns the childless home as not contributing to the perpetuation of the city. So there's a desirability for children. But it's so they can maintain the city and maintain ancestor worship and take care of the parents in old age. Under the next section, the exposure of infants, we read this. How many more children are welcome depends on circumstances. Children are expensive luxuries. I can testify that children are expensive. I have a 15-year-old. He has his learner's permit. He would like an automobile. That's not really the biggest expense, however. He's now tall enough to look me in the eye and is beginning to steal my clothing. His shoes have been much bigger than mine for some time, and he seems to need a new pair every 3 or 4 months. We can't keep him in pants that stay long enough. And he eats more than I ever remember eating in my lifetime. They're expensive. But I don't view my children as a luxury. But that's the way they viewed them in ancient Athens and in much of the rest of the world. They're expensive luxuries. They must be properly educated, and even the boys must be left a fair fortune. And in a footnote, he tells us that in that day and time, you didn't give a child an education and then send him off to make a living. You left him enough to live on. So you have to leave a fair fortune for the boys. The girls must always have good dowries or they cannot, quote, marry according to their station, end quote. Public opinion as well as the law allows a father, at least if he has 1 or 2 children already, to exercise a privilege which later ages will pronounce one of the foulest blots on Greek civilization. After the birth of a child, there is an anxious day or two for the poor young mother and the faithful nurses. Will he, that be the father, will he nourish it? Are there boys enough already? Is the disappointment over the birth of a daughter too keen? Does he dread the curtailment in family luxuries necessary to save up for an allowance or dowry for the little stranger? Or does the child promise to be puny, sickly, or even deformed? If any of these arguments carry adverse weight, there is no appeal against the father's decision. He has until the 5th day after the birth to decide. In the interval, he can utter the faithful words, expose it. No recourse on the part of the mother. If for whatever reason he decides we do not want this child, he simply says, expose it. And they take it out, lay it in a basket or a pot, whatever was available, near some public place, so that if somebody wanted to take that child and care for it, to raise it as a slave, they could do so. That's all that human life was good for. To speculate on as value as a slave. If the child had any obvious physical deformities or handicaps, no one would take it in. That's the world that the Lord's disciples in the first century went out into with the message of Christ and the gospel. So changed was that attitude that this man could tell us that it was something that we look upon as a terrible blot on that society. They so changed it that Singer could say that the dominant prevailing view for centuries was the Christian view. How did they do that? It's simple. They went out and preached the message of the gospel. There is a God in heaven that you are accountable before. He created you in His image. You've sinned. You face condemnation. He loved you enough, however, to send His Son to die in your stead. He paid the penalty for your sins. He proved this by raising Him from the dead on the 3rd day. Never to die again. He now sits at the right hand of God, reigning over the kingdom that the Old Testament prophet said that He would come and establish. If you've never done a study of the resurrection of Christ and the things that it establishes, I encourage you to do that. Paul used it in Acts the 17th chapter to establish the fact that we will one day stand in judgment before God. He's given us assurance in that he has raised him from the dead, Paul said on that hill in Athens, the very city we just read about, to tell people that they will stand and give an account. We can do the same thing. We don't have to understand all the different things that we teach when it comes to Christian evidences in support of creation. All we have to do is talk about the resurrection, really. There's no answer for the resurrection. None. The tomb is empty. And the only logical explanation for the empty tomb is that God raised Jesus from the dead. It establishes all that Jesus spoke of. It establishes all of the Bible, in my understanding, which proves the existence of God. Jesus claimed he was God. He tells us that there's a Father in heaven who sent him into this world. He told us he would be crucified and lay in the tomb 3 days and would then be resurrected. Luke tells us that it establishes the credibility of the writers of the New Testament. It proves the existence of God, the deity of Christ, the inspiration of the New Testament. The New Testament supports the inspiration of the Old Testament and helps to establish it. It establishes the coming resurrection of all the dead to stand before God in judgment. It proves the remission of sins. Now, people like Dr. Singer get a lot of attention, a lot of press. He'll probably appear on public television at some time or another to give a 13-week course on ethics. We're not going to be invited to do that. But we could be invited to our neighbors and the folks down the street and the folks in the next town. We can tell them about this Jesus, the God who sent him, what the Bible teaches. If they could do it in the first century, if they could change this view that they had of life to the one that became so dominant for so long in Western culture and society, why can't we? We serve the same God. After the first century, they did it without the benefit of any miraculous powers on the part of God being exercised. Did they not? I think it's time we stop sitting back and talking about how bad it is and do something about it, if we haven't been. I know I used to be frustrated over the subject of abortion, over the subject of euthanasia. I didn't quite know how to approach it. I'm glad Emmanuel made me. He didn't make me. He offered me the opportunity to present this material because it's made me realize what I need to do. It shouldn't have taken me this long to figure it out. We just need to do what Jesus said to do. Preach the gospel to every creature, helping them to understand that he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not is damned. It's not complicated. Sometimes we make it complicated, but it's not. We simply need to fulfill the Great Commission. And when we do it, people are going to understand that there is a God. There is a Savior. We are created in His image. He wants us to be with Him for eternity in heaven. He wants us to fulfill that longing that we have. That desire to know Him and enjoy fellowship with Him. And we can show people that Dr. Peter Singer is wrong. Not might be wrong, is wrong. We just need to be busy doing. I'm going to assume that you are here this morning and probably already believe in what God teaches about the value of life. That human life is valuable because it's created in the image of God. That there's a sanctity to that life. There's one other thing that establishes that, I believe. We talked about how origins helps to establish the value of something. One other thing that establishes value is the price that you're willing to pay for it. I've seen people go to auctions and spend a great deal of money for things that I kind of looked at and thought, I'm not sure why you want that so bad. But there was something about it that made it valuable, and they were willing to spend a great deal of money so that they could have it. The ultimate price was paid for you and for me at Calvary. If our lives were not worth something, if they weren't valuable, then Jesus would have never come into this world to die for us. But he did. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. John 3:16. He didn't do that for animals. He did it for us, for people, for humans, for men and women. Jesus came offering an opportunity for an abundant life. John 10:10. He came that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. He wants to give you an abundant life in this world and eternal life with him in heaven because your life is valuable to him. Have you accepted that offer? Are you a beneficiary of his death on your behalf this morning? Are you someone who once did, but you've no longer maintained that relationship with God? At somewhere, at some point, at some time, it became not that important, and you've forsaken it? Why not be restored to fellowship with him? Come back to the light that you might have that continued cleansing power of the blood of Christ, 1 John 1:7. Come back and walk in the light once again. Your life is valuable. My life is valuable. Every human's life is valuable. So much so that Jesus died for you. Are you willing to accept the benefits of that? If you're subject to the Lord's invitation this morning, we would invite you to come to the front, state how we might assist you, as together we stand and sing.
I filled with sorrow and care, heart was lonely and dear, burdens are there.